The Bodhisattva Ideal. Chapter 1. The Origin and Development of the Bodhisattva Ideal. One day, as was his custom, the Buddha was wandering with a few of his disciples in the depths of the Indian jungle, away from the heat of the noonday sun. As they were walking along, the Buddha bent down and scooped up a handful of sinsapa leaves. He didn't always give elaborate discourses. He often talked in a simple, direct way. And on this occasion, he simply asked his disciples, "Tell me, what do you think? These leaves in my hand, as compared with the leaves of the forest, are they few or are they many?" The disciples, of course, replied, "Well, in comparison with all the leaves in the forest, those in your hand are as nothing. They are just a handful." Then the Buddha said, "So it is with the truths I have realized, as compared with those I have revealed to you." The point is not that there were truths that the Buddha felt unable to communicate, but that there were certain things that he didn't consider it appropriate to teach. And the text goes on to explain why. Because those truths would not help his disciples to transcend suffering and attain enlightenment. Since the Buddha's time, of course, whole forests of Buddhist scriptures have appeared. But the same applies. Even though the scriptures are voluminous, they represent just a fraction of the Buddha's infinite knowledge and understanding. This is also true of the subject of this book. The Bodhisattva Ideal is a vast subject. It is the major distinctive emphasis of the phase of the development of Buddhism known as the Mahayana, which had its flowering for a period of about 500 years, 0 to 500 CE. But it is still practiced today in many different forms, from Tibetan Buddhism to Zen. To consider this topic is to place one's hand on the very heart of Buddhism and feel the beating of that heart. In a work of this size, one can do no more than touch on a few major themes. The intention here is therefore to present certain aspects of the Bodhisattva ideal, selected with the intention of focusing directly on spiritual life and experience, and including only a minimum of historical and doctrinal detail. Even in the handful of the Buddha's teachings which make up the Bodhisattva ideal, there are so many leaves that one hardly knows which to take up first. Perhaps it is best to begin right at the beginning with the word Bodhisattva. In Sanskrit, Bodhi means knowledge, in the sense of supreme knowledge, spiritual knowledge, knowledge of reality. And it also means awakening, in the sense of awakening to the ultimate truth of things, penetrating to the heart of existence. Bodhi is usually translated as enlightenment, which is good enough as a provisional translation, provided that we understand the word not in the 18th century rationalistic sense, but in its full spiritual, even transcendental sense. Bodhi is supreme spiritual knowledge, the great awakening that is the ultimate goal of the Buddhist life. Sattva means simply a being, not necessarily a human being, but any living being, even an animal or an insect. Thus, a bodhisattva is an enlightenment being, a being of awakening, a being whose whole life is dedicated, whose entire energies are devoted to the attainment of enlightenment. Some authorities hold that the Pali term bodhisatta should have been Sanskritized as bodhisakta, that is to say, one who is making an effort towards Buddhahood, sakta meaning striving. But the term settled upon was bodhisattva. Sattva meaning, as I have suggested, being in quite an ordinary sense. For instance, when one speaks of sarvasattva, all beings, one is not suggesting that all beings have the heroic qualities associated with sakta. Nonetheless, it may be that originally the term bodhisattva did have that connotation. In any case, there is no doubt that the ideal is a heroic ideal. The bodhisattva is a being par excellence, a being with a capital B. To say that a bodhisattva is a being whose life is totally dedicated to the attainment of enlightenment is no more than to say that the bodhisattva is the ideal Buddhist. Ideally, a Buddhist is dedicated to following the teaching of the Buddha and realizing the experience of enlightenment just as the Buddha did. The bodhisattva ideal is likewise the ideal of self-transformation from unenlightened to enlightened humanity. But the definition of bodhisattva goes even further. A bodhisattva is described as one who is dedicated to the attainment of enlightenment, not for his or her sake alone, but so that he or she may lead all living beings whatsoever to the same state. It seems strange that in the Buddhist texts, which predate the teaching of the bodhisattva ideal, there seem to be so few unequivocal statements to the effect that the aim of the spiritual life is to gain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. However, a few such statements are to be found in the Pali Canon. In the Anguttara Nikaya, for example, the Buddha speaks of four kinds of people: people who help neither themselves nor others, people who help others but not themselves, people who help themselves but not others, and people who help both themselves and others. That is quite clearly in the territory of the bodhisattva ideal. And in the Mahavagga of the Vinaya Pitaka, the Buddha addresses the first 60 arhants, an arhant, literally worthy one, being one who has gained enlightenment through the Buddha's teaching, saying, "Go forth, O monks, for the good of many people, the welfare of many people, out of compassion." Here again, the other regarding emphasis is very clear. So although altruism doesn't at first seem to be a predominant emphasis in the Pali Canon, it is definitely there. And if one disregards all those suttas that are spun out from scanty material, or seem to be later compilations, these altruistic elements form a considerable part of the canon as a whole. It is also possible that certain things got left out of the Pali Tipitaka and were subsequently incorporated into later texts, some of the Mahayana sutras, for example, in which compassion, the other regarding emphasis, is very strong. But even looking at the Pali Canon as it stands, there are enough indications to suggest that the original Buddhist ideal was not one of liberation for oneself alone. One might well imagine that at the time of the Buddha, people felt no need to spell this out so explicitly. If you had the example of the Buddha before you, you could hardly doubt that there was an other regarding aspect of the spiritual life. But later on, as we shall see, the self-regarding aspect became overstressed, so that there needed to be a compensatory counter-emphasis. To understand how this happened and why it became necessary to promote the ideal of enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings, we have to go back to the origins of Buddhism and also to consider certain fundamentals of human nature. One can often draw a sharp distinction between what a person is and does and what he or she says or writes. For example, a psychoanalyst may write a whole book about love: what it is, how it develops, how to maintain it, what to do when things go wrong, and so on. But although he may express himself so fluently on the subject, his own life may fail to be in any way an embodiment of love. On the other hand, some people may be seen clearly to embody love in their lives, radiating kindness, affection, and goodwill, but they may not be able to analyze it or put it into words at all, even to their nearest and dearest. Between being and doing on the one hand and verbal expression on the other, there is often this sort of chasm.
Words always express to some extent what we are, but they do not necessarily express what we think they express, or what we would like others to think they express. Sometimes our being is just not adequate to the words we say. For instance, if somebody asks you, "What is the goal of Buddhism?" and you say, Well, enlightenment, of course. Supreme enlightenment, you know, the unification of wisdom and compassion on the highest level. The words are formally correct, but your being is by no means adequate to what you have said. One could think of there being two circles, a great big circle, which is our words, and a tiny circle, which is our being. The aim is to make the two circles equally big. If one's words are too much out of harmony with one's being, people will notice the fact. Emerson said, "Don't say things. What you are stands over you the while and thunders so that I cannot hear what you say to the contrary." To talk about love while in a thoroughly irritable frame of mind is to communicate not love, but irritability. The difference between words and being applies on the very highest level. We may make the statement that the Buddha was or even is a fully enlightened being, but it is hard for us to imagine what that means. We read that a Buddha knows reality, that he is compassionate, wise, and so on, but these are just words. A great effort of imagination is required to realize what the words really mean, what a fully enlightened being really is. Indeed, if we encountered an enlightened being, we would be very unlikely to be able to recognize that he or she was enlightened. A Buddha's inner experience is expressed primarily in terms of what he is and does, and only secondarily in terms of what he says. Even though we have abundant records of what the Buddha said, even on the subject of enlightenment itself, a report, however accurate, of his words could never fully express what he was. This is evident from some of the incidents the Pali scriptures describe. The Buddha meets someone on the road, perhaps during his alms round, and, either in reply to a question or just spontaneously, gives a few words of instruction. The words are usually very simple, but to our astonishment we read that upon hearing them, the person listening becomes enlightened, just like that. How can that possibly be? We can't help asking this question. After all, we ourselves can read those same words 100 times over, but nothing much happens. There may be a glimmer of understanding. We may think, well, of course, obviously, no problem there. But we don't go spiralling up into enlightenment. How was it that when they were originally spoken, those words produced such a dramatic effect? Sometimes the listener would have been prepared to be receptive to them by many years of previous spiritual training. But the main factor to be taken into consideration is the Buddha himself. Those words didn't just appear in the air. It was the Buddha who spoke them, and that made all the difference. In a sense, it didn't matter what he said. It was who he was that produced the impression. The being of other people always does impinge on us in that direct, being-to-being way. We often get a definite impression of someone before we have spoken to or even looked at them. In the same way, the being of the Buddha can impinge on the being of the ordinary person, if they are receptive. The Buddha can't impose his being on us. There needs to be an element of cooperation. People may impinge on us in such a way as to change our mental state, but a permanent change comes about only with transcendental insight into the true nature of things. Even a Buddha cannot produce insight in a person. He can only give one an opportunity to develop it oneself. Could he make it easier for one to be receptive? There is a parallel discussion in Christian theology. You need the grace of God to be saved, but you are not completely passive. You have to be able to receive that grace. Does that mean there is another grace which has enabled you to receive grace? The Buddhist conundrum is more or less the same. Do you need the Buddha's help to enable you to be open to the possibility of his helping you? At some level this must be so, but it is a regressive train of thought, and perhaps it is best not to take even the first step backwards. The point is that one needs to be open to whatever the Buddha can give. One might think that to be directly influenced by the Buddha would involve being in his presence. We shall see that the Mahayana took quite seriously the idea that one could choose to be reborn at a time and in a place in which one might encounter a Buddha. However, this hypothesis is not strictly necessary, because in any case the limitations of space and time don't apply, presumably, to mental states. One could, with sufficient effort and receptivity, simply feel oneself to be in the presence of the Buddha. The meditation practices of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that involve visualizing a Buddha or Bodhisattva work in this way. One constructs a mental image of a Buddha or Bodhisattva. This is called the Samayasattva, the conventional being. It doesn't just appear, you have to bring it into being, which is not an easy thing to do. But eventually, on the basis of the visualization of the Samayasattva, the Jnanasattva, or knowledge being, an actual experience of the Buddha or Bodhisattva can manifest. Practices such as this are a testament to the true nature of the Buddha's teaching. Whether he gave a long discourse or whether he said nothing at all, he influenced people more by what he was and what he did than by what he said. The man himself, the enlightened man, was the message. One could even say that Buddhism is the Buddha, and the Buddha is Buddhism. During his lifetime, many people became enlightened, not just because of the words he said, words which are still available in the scriptures, but because of his tremendous presence. Nothing he said could adequately express what he was. This is what the story of the Tsingtsapa leaves is really saying, that what the Buddha said and what he was were incommensurable. After the Buddha's death, called his parinirvana, as it is not death as we understand it, but rather an extension of his experience of enlightenment, things were different. The accounts of what happened are contradictory, but they agree that not long after the Buddha's parinirvana, a large number of his disciples held a meeting to discuss a crucial question. What is Buddhism? This question is, if anything, still more crucial to us today. So far as we are concerned, the Buddha is dead. Not just in the historical sense, but in the sense that we are dead to, not aware of, not awake to, our own Buddha nature. For a Buddhist, what is Buddhism is, of course, not a theoretical question, but an essentially practical one. What one really wants to know is, what is the path to the realization of enlightenment? How can I contact my own lost Buddhahood? It is important that these two questions are taken together. In a sense, we can consider that Buddha nature is innate within us, but we will have to engage in a process of change, growth, and development. That is, we will have to find and follow a path to realize our potential for enlightenment. It seems that after the Buddha's parinirvana, there were among his disciples two parties representing two different points of view. One party said, in effect, that Buddhism is the teaching of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Conditioned Existence, the 12 Links of the Chain of Conditioned Co-Production, and so on. These teachings, given by the Buddha during his lifetime, constitute Buddhism, they said. Reasonable enough, one might think. But the other party disagreed. Not that they rejected the Buddha's teachings. On the contrary, they valued it very highly. But they did not agree that Buddhism was fully embodied in the Buddha's verbal teaching. According to these people, and they seem to have been in the majority, one had also to take into account a second factor, the life and example of the Buddha himself. This, in their view, was even more important than the doctrinal teachings. What made them think this? We can get a feeling for the answer to this question, we are never going to know for sure, by trying to place ourselves imaginatively in their position. And doing so will also bring us very close to the origin of the Bodhisattva ideal. When the Buddha died, by all accounts, his disciples were grief-stricken. Well, not quite all of them. Although even the gods, as well as unenlightened human beings, are represented as being utterly distraught, we are told that the arhants, those who were themselves enlightened, remained absolutely calm and unmoved. Their realization that even a Buddha must die, in the sense that his physical body must break up, was so profound that they didn't feel any sense of loss. After all, what had they to lose? Inasmuch as they were enlightened, they had the Buddha with them. In a sense, they were the Buddha. Enlightenment was neither theirs as a personal possession, nor the Buddha's as a personal possession. There had been no essential change. They certainly hadn't lost the Buddha, because they hadn't lost Buddhahood. And it is Buddhahood that makes a Buddha a Buddha. Whether there was a difference between the enlightenment of the Buddha and that of his enlightened disciples is a question we will consider later in this chapter. Arhants may have been able to face the Buddha's death with equanimity, but to those who were not themselves enlightened, enlightenment was inevitably associated with the physical body of the Buddha. When he died, it was though enlightenment itself had disappeared from the universe. Some people exclaimed, "The eye of the world has disappeared." And although this wasn't really true, a cloud had moved across the face of the sun, but the sun was still shining. It felt true, and they were devastated. According to tradition, even the animals were affected. There are beautiful representations in Buddhist art, especially that produced in China, of this solemn final scene, set in a grove of sal trees. The major events of the Buddha's life, his birth, enlightenment, and parinirvana, all took place, according to the scriptures, beneath trees. Sal trees are still a common sight in India. They are perfectly straight with a slender trunk, broad green leaves, and beautiful white flowers. We are told that the Buddha passed away lying on a stone couch at the foot of a group of these sal trees. Also vividly depicted are the disciples, monks, kings, queens, princes, merchants, wandering mendicants, Brahmins, traders, flower sellers, grouped around the Buddha in attitudes of grief. A little further away are the wild beasts of the forest, as well as a number of domesticated animals, and all of them, human beings and animals too, are weeping, as if the whole world shared a common grief in the loss of the Buddha. But even though the disciples felt that the light of the world had gone out, still, slowly, they recovered from their grief, as we all have to recover on these occasions, and started to take stock of the situation. Unbelievable as it seemed at first, the Buddha was gone, and they had to settle down to life in a Buddha-less world, which, especially for those who had lived in his presence for many years, was a terrible change. But, eventually, they started trying to understand what they were left with. And some, perhaps the intellectuals among them, said, "Well, we've got the teachings the Buddha gave us, the doctrines, the rules of behaviour, and so on. That's enough, surely." One can imagine that these were the kind of people who went on to spend their lives happily analysing and classifying the teachings, and later began the tradition that became what is known as the Abhidharma. But there were many among the disciples of the Buddha who, while they had nothing against the teachings or the rules, felt there was something missing from their lives now that the Buddha had gone. We can imagine that even when they were supposed to be thinking of the teachings and committing those long lists of terms to memory, they couldn't help thinking of the Buddha and recalling incidents in his life that exemplified his personal qualities. For instance, some of them no doubt remembered the occasion when the Buddha was going round from one hermitage to the next and found in one hut an elderly monk lying on the floor in a terrible condition. He had dysentery. It was obvious that he had been lying there for days without receiving any help at all. The Buddha asked the old man why the other monks weren't looking after him, and he said, "Well, I'm useless to them now. Why should they bother to look after me?" So the Buddha sent his companion, Ananda, to fetch warm water, and together they lifted the old monk onto a bed, washed him, and made him comfortable. Then the Buddha called all the monks together and said, "Monks, you have neither father nor mother, brother nor sister. You have given up the world. You must be brother and sister, mother and father to one another. He who wishes to serve me, let him serve the sick." Incidents like this, incidents which show the Buddha's practical compassion, must surely have remained in the minds and hearts of many of his disciples. Some of them, especially the lay disciples, might also have remembered the story of Kissa Gotami. In India in those days, as now, infant mortality was very high, and the story goes that a young woman called Kissa Gotami lost her only child when he was only a few years old. Unable to believe he was dead, crazed with grief, she took his body in her arms from house to house, asking for medicine to make him well again. Eventually, someone had the good sense and kindness to suggest that she should go to the Buddha for help. So she went to him and asked him to bring her baby back to life. He didn't refuse. He didn't give her a sermon. He knew that would be useless, grief-stricken as she was. In fact, he didn't answer her question directly at all. He just said, "Bring me just a few grains of mustard seed, but bring them from a house where no one has died." So off she went, going from one house to another. Everywhere she went, the people were more than willing to give her some mustard seed. But when she asked, "Has anyone died in this house?" they said, "Do not remind us of our grief. The dead are many, but the living are few." At every house she learned the same lesson. Death comes to all. Eventually she laid her child's body to rest in the jungle, came back to the Buddha and sat quietly at his feet. She didn't say anything for a long time. Then at last she said, "Give me a refuge." And she became a nun. The obvious contrast is with the story of Jesus' raising of Lazarus from the dead. If both stories are true, there appears to be a tremendous difference between them as spiritual teachings. The Buddha pointing out, however gently, that death is natural and inevitable, while Jesus conveys a very different message. As represented in the Gospels, Jesus wasn't so much concerned to give teachings, although he did give some, of course, as to demonstrate that he was the Son of God. The Gospel according to John, chapter 11, verse 4, reports that on hearing of the illness of his friend Lazarus, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. It has come for the glory of God, to bring glory to the Son of God." If you regard God as the creator of the world and of mankind, the master of life and death, to be able to bring a dead man back to life is to prove that you have some transcendent power, even that you are God. Down the ages, Christians have regarded Christ's miracle as proof of his claim that he was the Son of God. The Buddha was not concerned to establish any such claim. He wasn't even concerned to establish the fact that he was enlightened. His only concern was to point out the way to enlightenment to those who were looking for it. When Kissa Gotami came to him, there was no question of his bringing her son back to life to prove anything about himself. He focused on the important thing, the compassionate demonstration of the truth about life and death. In Christianity, a great deal of importance has been attached to the miracles of Christ, and when they are questioned, some Christians tend to feel that the foundations of their faith are being shaken. But Buddhists don't feel that way about the miracles of the Buddha. The Pali scriptures describe plenty of supernormal happenings, but you can question those and leave the Buddha's central teaching intact. The scriptures also describe miracles being performed on a regular basis by people like Devadatta, who has traditionally been regarded as the villain of the Pali canon and very far from being enlightened. Kissa Gotami was exceptional in making a lifelong commitment to spiritual practice as a result of this incident. A question for us is how to sustain a realization brought by painful experience so that we don't lose the new direction in life that it might initiate. We possess the ability to forget, mercifully in some cases, but unfortunately, very often the positive realization arising from painful experiences are the very aspect of those experiences that are lost. To safeguard one's insights, one has to be careful not to plunge straight back into the distractions of one's old way of life, but to take the opportunity to make changes that will help to preserve and strengthen one's insight. It seems strange that one can have an intense experience and that it then can disappear almost entirely overnight, but it can happen. With effort, though, insights can be preserved through sustained mindfulness and the help of one's friends. The rest of Kisa Gotami's story makes it clear that she was able to do that, and remembering her would have reminded people of the Buddha's skillful compassion. As for the Buddha's more vigorous qualities, his fearlessness and equanimity, these would have been recalled particularly in connection with his cousin Devadatta. Devadatta was a very ambitious man. Having been a monk for a number of years, he was very good at meditation and had all sorts of supernormal powers, but he was ambitious and proud. One day, when the Buddha was a very old man, Devadatta said to him, "Lord, why don't you just go into retreat? Spend your old age quietly and happily. Don't give yourself any trouble. I will lead the Sangha for you." But the Buddha, knowing perfectly well what Devadatta was up to, said, "I wouldn't hand over the Sangha even to Sariputta and Moggallana, the Buddha's chief disciples, much less to you." Devadatta was so incensed, so offended by these words, that he resolved to take the Buddha's life. He conspired with Ajatasattu, a wicked king with whom he was on friendly terms, and together they bribed the king's elephant trainer to release a mad elephant in the Buddha's path. When it saw the Buddha, however, the mad elephant calmed down and became perfectly tame. Devadatta became more and more desperate. Knowing that the Buddha used to walk in the valley below the great rock called the Vulture's Peak, he climbed up and sent a boulder bouncing down the hillside towards the Buddha. It missed, but a splinter pierced the Buddha's foot and drew blood. After these incidents, the Buddha's disciples became alarmed for his safety. To protect him, they formed a sort of bodyguard and, armed with sticks, ring the vihara where he was sleeping. During the night, the Buddha came out of the vihara. He never slept through until morning, but sat up half the night meditating and saw all these monks on guard. He said, "Monks, what is this? What are you doing?" They said, "Lord, we're protecting you." But the Buddha said, "The Buddha needs no protection. Go to your dwellings." So they all melted away into the night, leaving the Buddha by himself. This was the Buddha's spirit. This was his fearlessness. According to early Buddhist tradition, it is simply against the nature of things that a Buddha should be killed. We can't tell when exactly this doctrinal concept arose, but it is very much in accord with what could be called the aristocratic attitude of early Buddhism. The first Buddhists had a strong sense of the dignity of the enlightened person and seemed to have been unable to imagine that dignity being affronted. It follows that the nature of the universe was such as to guarantee that the Buddha would come to no harm. Early Buddhists would have been unable to countenance the idea of the Buddha's being humiliated and killed in the way that Christians believed Jesus was. Something like it does crop up later in the Buddhist tradition in the Mahayana, which regards the Bodhisattva as undergoing all sorts of pain and suffering. But there is no suggestion that the Bodhisattva is martyred or humiliated. If one looks at the matter aside from all doctrinal assumptions, however, there is no reason why even a Buddha might not die an unnatural death. There are instances of arhants being killed. Moggallana, for example, was murdered. And the Tibetan enlightened ascetic Milarepa was apparently poisoned, as other Buddhist teachers have also been. It would seem likely that the doctrine that a Buddha could not be killed arose not out of the nature of Buddhism itself, so much as out of the general cultural come spiritual assumptions of India, especially upper caste Indian society at that time.
On the other hand, Perhaps it is against the nature of things for a Buddha to be killed. Perhaps the universe itself would prevent that from happening. It does no harm at all to think of the universe as being alive. The view we have inherited from late 19th century science is that the universe is dead, more like a motor car than a human body. But at least metaphorically, one can usefully think of the universe as being much more like a living being, and this is certainly the way it has been viewed by some, the Platonists, for instance. Indeed, the universe may be seen not only as being alive, but as having a living, even an ethical and spiritual equilibrium that would correct any such imbalance as would be represented by the killing of a Buddha. Certain organs in the body carry out all sorts of complicated functions as though they had an intelligence, not an individual consciousness, but something more than a series of mechanical reactions. Perhaps there is something in the world, or in the universe, that is analogous to that subconscious intelligence. A sort of intelligence which is capable of intervening to protect the safety and well-being of the organism, in this case the world, or even the cosmos, as a whole. But even if it is true that it is impossible for a Buddha to be killed, that takes nothing away from the Buddha's personal courage. Perhaps one could say that the fearlessness, which was one of his outstanding qualities, helped to keep him safe from harm. The Buddha's calm, radiant presence also expressed itself in his love of silence. This quality is famously exhibited in the story of how Jivaka, who was the Buddha's physician and also the physician of King Ajatasattu, took the king on a midnight visit to see the Buddha. Apparently the king and his courtiers were all sitting on the roof of the palace admiring the moon. It was the full moon of October, when the lotus is supposed to bloom, and they agreed that it was a wonderful night to visit a holy man. Typically Indian this, not a wonderful night for a beach barbecue, but a wonderful night to visit a holy man. So they set off, and being a king, Ajatasattu had to go in style. We are told that 500 elephants were saddled and 500 ladies of the harem took their seats on the elephants, and they all went off, with the king and Jivaka at their head, to visit the Buddha in the depth of the forest. But as they went further and further into the forest, and as it got darker and darker, the party spirit began to wear off, at least as far as the king was concerned. Apart from experiencing the general stress of being weighed down by the cares and anxieties of kingship, he had ascended his throne by foul means, so he had a guilty conscience as well. Becoming fearful and suspicious, he stopped and said, "Jivaka, are you leading me into a trap?" But Jivaka said, "Don't be afraid, Your Majesty. It's just a little way ahead. The Buddha is staying in the depths of the forest." They went on further, and it became still darker and still more silent, until they couldn't hear anything at all, except presumably for the sound of 500 elephants walking. But elephants can walk very quietly. Ajatasattu said again, "Are you sure you're not leading me into a trap?" And Jivaka repeated, "Don't worry, Your Majesty, there's no trap." Ajatasattu didn't believe him, though. He said, "You've told me that the Buddha is living here with 2,500 monks. We should be able to hear them a mile away, but there isn't a sound, and you're trying to tell me this isn't a trap." But Jivaka insisted, "Don't worry, look, just over there, you can see the lights burning in the Buddha's pavilion." Sure enough, in a great clearing in the trees, there was the Buddha, in the midst of 2,500 disciples, all perfectly silent, sitting in the light of the full moon. When the king, with all his fears and suspicions, came upon this sight, he said to Jivaka, "Oh, that my son might experience peace of mind such as this." In India, people are much attached to their sons and make all their wishes and aspirations on their behalf. So here again we find the Buddha communicating a particular quality of his presence, his love of peace, solitude, and silence. This too his disciples must have remembered after his death. Of course we know this because the story has come down to us.
They also remembered some very different stories concerning what we would call miracles. They would have seen or heard about all sorts of odd things that used to happen when the Buddha was around. Supernormal happenings for which there was no rational explanation. They would have told how when the Buddha was staying anywhere during the night, marvellous figures, devas or gods, would be seen hovering around. And they would relate how the most marvellous aspect of these apparitions was the fact that they were there to learn from the Buddha. He would teach them the Dharma during the night, just as he taught human beings during the day. The appearance of devas would not itself have been regarded as a miraculous event, a pratihariya. A pratihariya would be something like the incident described in the Mahavastu, in which the Buddha walks up and down in the air, emitting fire and water simultaneously. But the existence of devas would have been taken for granted in the Buddha's time. They are certainly supernormal beings, and one could regard their appearance before the Buddha as a supernormal happening. It clearly wasn't taking place on the ordinary material plane. But it wasn't due to the Buddha himself, although he may have had the supernormal power of creating what people might take to be a deva. Nevertheless, such incidents added to the general stock of stories and anecdotes, which must have been fresh in the hearts and minds of his disciples. Many of them must have felt that these stories communicated something of tremendous importance, something the formal teachings did not convey, the effect the Buddha had on those with whom he came in contact, the direct impact of an enlightened being which is an above and beyond all words. No one could have been a better judge of this than the Buddha's cousin Ananda, who for more than 20 years was the Buddha's personal attendant and went with him everywhere. If the Buddha was invited to lunch, Ananda went too. If the Buddha went to give a sermon, Ananda went along. If the Buddha received visitors or answered questions, Ananda was present. He was always there, like the Buddha's shadow. And the Buddha, we gather, was all in all to him. When the Buddha was about to die, Ananda, understandably, felt it more deeply than anybody. According to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, as the Buddha lay in the sal grove, Ananda left him and went to a nearby lodging house. There he stood at the door of the hut and leaned against the doorpost. As he stood there, he tried to realize that the Buddha was going to die in a matter of days or even hours. Weeping bitterly, he said to himself, "The Master is about to pass away from me, he who is so kind." These words are of the greatest significance. In the course of the 20 years Ananda had spent with the Buddha, he must have heard the Buddha deliver hundreds of discourses, including many abstruse, philosophical, deeply mystical teachings. He had heard him answer thousands of questions. He must have admired his brilliance, his affability, the easy way he handled difficult questions. No doubt he had witnessed all kinds of supernormal happenings. But it was not the Buddha's wisdom or his understanding of philosophy, his skill in debate or his ability to work miracles, his courage or his tireless energy that stood out. For Ananda, the Buddha's outstanding quality was his kindness. After all those years in which he had heard so much, the overall impression the Buddha had made upon Ananda is summed up in those few words, "He who is so kind." Half of Buddhism is in that remark. And here we return to our theme. It also gives us the origin of the Bodhisattva ideal. The Buddha's wisdom is revealed in his doctrinal teachings, but his love, his compassion, which so deeply impressed Ananda, is revealed in his personal example. This is what those disciples who could not identify Buddhism exclusively from the verbal teaching of the Buddha were getting at. They were saying that Buddhism was not just wisdom, as represented by the teaching, but also love and compassion, as exemplified by the Buddha's life. And in any formulation of Buddhism, both should be taken into consideration. Yes, we should try to attain enlightenment, to awaken, to see the truth. This is the wisdom aspect. but we should try to attain wisdom for the sake of all sentient beings. This is the compassion aspect. These two together form the Bodhisattva ideal.
It could be said that Ananda was the first exemplar of the Bodhisattva ideal, in that he looked after the Buddha rather than thinking about his own needs all the time, although he was a serious spiritual practitioner in his own right. It is perhaps significant that Ananda functioned after the Buddha's parinirvana, as far as we can tell from the records, in much the same way the Buddha had functioned. He went around from place to place preaching the Dharma with a large following of bhikkhus. In fact, he was criticized for doing that. If anybody came close to the spirit of the Buddha, it does seem to have been Ananda. The records are imperfect, it is difficult to be sure, but Ananda certainly comes across as an attractive character in a way that arhants like Mahakashyapa or even Moggallana do not. It is sometimes suggested that Ananda delayed his own development for the sake of taking care of the Buddha, and he therefore didn't gain enlightenment until after the Buddha's death. That's rather a superficial way of looking at it. It would suggest that service is not a part of spiritual development, which it very definitely is. One might even say that it is a surer path of spiritual development, in that one has to give up one's own ego, one's own interests, one's own desires, in the way that Ananda must have done. Ananda didn't opt for an easier or more mundane path in agreeing to look after the Buddha. Neither is there any suggestion in the scriptures that he nobly sacrificed his own spiritual development to that worthy task. It is true that the Pali scriptures represent him as attaining arhatship after the parinirvana, but there is no suggestion that the delay arose because he was caught up with serving the Buddha. Though it is perhaps interesting that there was a delay. Perhaps it suggests that Ananda didn't conceive of the spiritual life as having a definite goal out there in the way that perhaps the other arhats did. Ananda seems to have been less goal-orientated, in a positive way. But there is more research to be done in this matter, as with so many aspects of the tradition. We can reflect on their spiritual significance, but their historical origins are very difficult to disentangle. It is not easy to trace, either, exactly how the Bodhisattva ideal emerged in the form of a movement which finally felt it had to distinguish itself from those who did not share its vision. At some point, its adherents started to call their approach the Mahayana, or Great Way, and refer to those who rejected that approach as followers of the Hinayana, the Lesser Way. Of the various early Buddhist schools, the only one still in existence today, and the only representative of Hinayana Buddhism, is the Theravada. The issue is far from clear-cut, however. The teachings preserved by the Theravada over the centuries clearly register a good deal of the spirit of the Buddha's teaching as well as its letter. If the Hinayanists weren't interested in the life of the Buddha, how is it that all these stories were so diligently preserved in the Pali canon? Can it really be that they were more interested in the Buddha's teachings than in his life, given that they preserved all these incidents in their own scriptures? One could argue that they might well have preserved teachings to which they did not attach much importance, their primary concern being to preserve whatever they could. We can be very glad that they did. Without the different versions of the scriptures they preserved, we could have no idea of what Buddhism was like in the early days. We certainly couldn't discover this from the Mahayana scriptures, which on the whole represent an effort to achieve a complete reconstruction of the teachings, and are generally concerned not with the historical Buddha, but more with what one might call the Buddha's archetypal life. However selective the later portions of the Pali Canon are, they contain at least some elements of the original teaching from which it can be reconstructed. Some Mahayana texts, the Ratnakuta Sutras, for example, do seem to contain traces of the Buddha's original teaching. Others, however, like the White Lotus Sutra, almost certainly have no direct connection with the teaching of the historical Buddha at all. From the Mahayana Sutras, we may get a good understanding of the spirit of Buddhism, but if we want to reconstruct the original letter through which that spirit found expression, we have to go principally to the Pali Canon. In any case, as we have seen, from the Pali text we get a strong sense of that spirit through the vivid picture of the Buddha's life and character they present. So how did the self-styled Mahayanists come to take such a dim view of their fellow Buddhists? This brings us back to a question we encountered earlier. Was there a difference between the enlightenment of the Buddha and that of his enlightened followers? Could the ideal of enlightenment possibly degenerate? In the beginning, there was Buddhahood. The ideal the Buddha set out for all men and women was that of attaining enlightenment, just as he himself had done. When his disciples attained that goal, as many of them did, the Buddha did not distinguish, it would seem, between the contents of their enlightenment and his own. He is reported as saying, "O monks, I am free from all bonds, human and divine. You also are free from all bonds, human and divine," which suggests that he saw their attainment as equal to his. The only difference was that the Buddha realized the truth first, and the disciples realized it afterwards by following the Buddha's teaching. So their enlightenment was termed Anubodhi, subsequent enlightenment. The Buddha's discovery of the path to enlightenment made him unique. A special significance always attaches to a pioneer. Because he is the first, he sets the pattern. But if the Arhants had attained exactly what the Buddha had attained, why was the Buddha so greatly missed after his death? The scriptures give the impression that the Buddha definitely had something that his enlightened disciples did not. He seems to have had a commanding personality and more character than the others, even if they were all equal as regards enlightenment. Later Mahayana doctrine says that due to his punya, his merit, the Buddha was of extraordinarily impressive appearance, tall, well-built, handsome, dignified, with a beautiful speaking voice. All this wouldn't have made him any wiser, but it did provide his wisdom with a very effective instrument, which might have meant that he had a greater influence. In the Pali scriptures, Arhants like Shariputra are sometimes to be found teaching quite successfully. But the Buddha seems to have had by far the greater ability to communicate. As far as one can tell, some of the enlightened disciples hardly communicated at all. Perhaps they just didn't have that gift. But that statement would be seen as a contradiction in terms by the later Mahayana tradition, which came to regard the gift of communication almost as an integral part of enlightenment, an aspect of the Buddha's upaya, his skillful means. If you are enlightened, the suggestion is, you will be able to communicate your experience effectively and will want to do so. If you have wisdom, you will also have compassion. Perhaps one could conclude that the Buddha was simply more enlightened. Enlightenment is not a full stop. We tend to think of it as being a fixed state that you attain and stay in, but perhaps one should think more in terms of indefinite development. Beyond a certain point, we can't track the Buddha anymore. The Dhammapada calls him the trackless one. But the point at which he disappears from view is not necessarily the goal. Further vistas may lie beyond. But as the generations went by, Buddhists came to feel that there was a difference between the enlightenment of the Buddha and the experience of his enlightened followers, Arhants, worthy ones. The Buddha had been the pioneer. He had rediscovered the Dharma at a time when it was lost, and the idea developed that he had qualified himself to do this by practicing the paramitas, or perfections, for countless lives. Not having had that particular task to do, the Arhants didn't need to go through that period of intensive training, so their achievement was less than that of a Buddha. Thus it was argued. At the same time, within 100 years of the Buddha's parinirvana, there seems to have been a sort of ossification of the ideal of enlightenment, or rather of the understanding of that ideal. It seems that over time, the Arhat ideal degenerated until it came to signify a narrow, individualistic conception of enlightenment. The original Buddhist way of looking things was probably more open and fluid. The early Buddhist schools came to rather caricature their own conception of Arhats, portraying them as dry, emotionless figures, and the Mahayanists tended to inherit that attitude. However, the Mahayanists were not satisfied that this conception accurately portrayed the highest ideal of the original spirit of the Buddha's teachings. It was this that led to a whole new phase in the history of Buddhism and the origin of what became known as the Bodhisattva ideal. Ultimately, one cannot conceive of enlightenment as being either for oneself or not for oneself, for others or not for others. It is impossible to separate the self-regarding aspect of spiritual development from the other regarding aspect. But the Mahayanists saw a need to distinguish the two and to criticize the other schools for promulgating a Hinayana, a lesser way, which limited the ideal of enlightenment to its self-regarding aspect. Some of the Mahayana sutras didn't just promote the Bodhisattva ideal, but went so far as to present the Arhat ideal as inferior per se. For instance, in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Shariputra is portrayed as a sort of fall guy, forever having his literalism exposed by the Mahayanist Vimalakirti, even though the Buddha's original Sangha is by no means synonymous or identifiable with what became known as the Hinayana. Why did the Mahayana writers resort to such tactics? The reason can be traced back to something quite simple, but at the same time perhaps hard for us to understand. In ancient India, people had no conception of historical development. It is natural to us to think in terms of historical progression, so natural that it's hard to imagine not doing so. But it wasn't natural to ancient Indian Buddhists. Faced with the Arhat ideal as then presented, which they found unacceptable, they nonetheless had to accept it as having been taught by the Buddha. It wasn't available to them to think that the Buddha had in fact taught something different, and that in the course of time the teaching had degenerated, producing this rather negative ideal. They had to see whatever process had happened as having taken place within the lifetime of the Buddha himself, and all the different teachings and ideals as having been taught by the Buddha. The way they made sense of this discrepancy was to think that the Buddha, confronted by people of different spiritual capacities, taught them different ideals. As they saw it, the Buddha did teach the Arhat ideal as they understood it, but only as a provisional teaching for those who were comparatively undeveloped. To those who were ready for a more advanced teaching, he taught the Bodhisattva ideal. This rationale is one of the major themes of many well-known Mahayana texts. With the coming of the Tiantai school in 6th century China, a more historical perspective dawned. All the teachings of the Buddha were classified into 5 great periods, and the different sutras were allocated between them. But it is only in comparatively recent times that, due to the influence of Western evolutionary modes of thinking, it has been possible to think in terms of a development of Buddhism, or for that matter, a development of Christianity or any other religion. The historical perspective available to us entirely alters the situation. It means, for example, that we don't have to think in terms of a limited Arhat ideal. We can think of the Buddha as having originally presented the ideal of enlightenment as fully as he possibly could, and we can imagine that people in his own time and for generations afterwards had a full sense of what he meant. As the years went by, however, that understanding degenerated. A distinction came to be drawn between the attainment of the Buddha and that of the Arhats, and the latter came to be regarded as a lesser attainment. Hence the need for the Mahayana's restatement of the whole teaching to bring the emphasis back to where the Buddha himself originally placed it. The Mahayanists tried to unify the goal again, saying that Buddhahood was open to all, and that one should aim not for arhantship, the lesser goal, but for supreme enlightenment. There are no detailed records, so we don't know much about the practical consequences of the development of these ideas. But we can extrapolate back from the accounts given by some of the Chinese pilgrims. Xuan Sang makes it clear that at the time he visited India in the 7th century, followers of the Hinayana and followers of the Mahayana lived side by side in the same monasteries, observing approximately the same monastic discipline. They differed only in that the Mahayana monks studied the Mahayana sutras in addition to the Agamas, the Sanskrit equivalent of the Pali Nikayas, and worshipped the archetypal bodhisattvas. To hazard a parallel, one might say it was a bit like the difference between high church and low church in the Church of England. In the same parish, you may find one priest who is rather low church and another who is rather high church, but both belong to the same broad church. The difference between Hinayana and Mahayana seems to have been as unremarkable as that, until the Vajrayana emerged and there was something of a collapse of monastic discipline. Those who were following the Vajrayana could hardly remain within the monastery if they no longer observed the monastic discipline, and we know that many, those who conformed more to the Siddha ideal, consciously chose not to. But so long as Hinayanists and Mahayanists continued to observe the same monastic discipline, they apparently didn't feel any need to live in different establishments on account of their different views. Similarly, in a present-day Buddhist community, the residents might agree to follow the same way of life, to meditate morning and evening, to be vegetarian and abstain from alcohol, to follow right livelihood, and so on. Some might be studying Mahayana scriptures, some might be studying the Pali Canon, others might be reading translations of Tibetan tantric works, but so long as a common way of life and common ethical principles were observed, it would be possible for community members to live together quite happily. Something like that seems to have happened in medieval India, with the Vinaya, the text detailing monastic codes of conduct, providing the ethical basis for the practice of both Hinayana and Mahayana. But there was no corresponding communality of views, it seems. After the split, there was very little in the way of discussion or controversy between the two parties, for the simple reason that the various Hinayana schools ignored the Mahayana, as the Theravada has continued to do for the most part until the present time. One of the works of the Theravada Abhidharma, the Katavatu, or Points of Controversy, records a number of discussions between the Theravadan schools and Proto-Mahayana schools, but that is the only such account we have. Over the years, the two became geographically isolated. It was in Sri Lanka that the Theravada was preserved, and there, according to the Theravadan tradition, that the Pali Canon was first written down. At the Fourth Council, held in Aluvihara in the 1st century BCE. The Sinhalese Theravadins were much opposed to certain quasi-Mahayanistic schools which gained a foothold in Sri Lanka. Of the two great Sinhalese monasteries, the Mahavihara and the Abhayagiri Vihara, the Abhayagiri was Mahayanistically inclined, but with the help of King Parakama, it was eventually suppressed in the 12th century. We know very little about what was taught there. Theravadan sources give the impression that whatever it was so dreadful that no decent Theravadin could possibly go into details. Meanwhile, as Mahayana Buddhism spread to Tibet, China, and Japan, the Mahayana became dissociated from its Hinayana monastic basis. And there was a complicating factor in that a sort of Mahayana Vinaya sprang up. In India, and later on in Tibet, this was observed in addition to the Hinayana Vinaya, as a Mahayanistic supplement for bodhisattvas. In the end, the whole thing became rather ponderous. For all these reasons, the two trends in Buddhism came to develop completely different ways of expressing the path to enlightenment, to the extent that comparison between the two is very difficult. One could be forgiven, indeed, for wondering whether it is the same enlightenment that is being referred to. We should remember, though, that in intention, both refer back to the enlightened experience and inspiration of the Buddha. That is their starting point. Throughout this study of the Bodhisattva ideal, we shall return again and again to consider the correspondences between the two approaches, for the simple reason that it is spiritually fruitful to do so. With the historical perspective available to us, we can appreciate and learn from both. When one first approaches Buddhism, there is no need to unravel all the historical complications. It is enough just to consider the Buddha's life and the spiritual life in general. The basic point is that Buddhism teaches a balanced spiritual ideal, emphasizing both wisdom and compassion. The task for Western Buddhists is to sort out what is really useful in the Buddhist tradition, what the Buddha really did teach, and what we ourselves find helpful in our own spiritual lives. After the split, it was not the case that all Mahayanists imaginatively embraced the spirit of the teaching, while all Hinayanists rigidly adhered to the letter. The fact that technically you belong to the school of the spirit doesn't automatically mean that you yourself are more observant of the spirit than the letter. Mahayanists have no room for complacency here. In any case, nobody is always Mahayanist or always Hinayanist. On any occasion, whatever one's spiritual context, one may adopt either a so-called Hinayana, i.e. self-regarding attitude, or a so-called Mahayana, i.e. other-regarding attitude. There have been plenty of Mahayanists who have stuck to the letter of the Mahayana in a very un-Mahayanistic way, and there are certainly many Theravadins who live in accordance with the spirit rather than the letter of the Theravada. And, because of course one's own behaviour should be the primary object of one's scrutiny, at any time it is useful to ask oneself which attitude one is adopting in, say, one's meditation practice or one's work. Basically, all Buddhists need to remember that the Buddha and his compassionate spirit cannot be left out of Buddhism. It is essentially as a reminder of this that Buddhists engage in devotional practice or puja, worship. This is a fundamental aspect of a bodhisattva's practice, as we shall see. The puja brings us face to face with the Buddha. Literally, if we sit directly facing the image of the Buddha on the shrine. As we look at that image, the teaching can be for a moment forgotten. For a moment we are face to face with Buddhahood, and, contemplating it, we recognize our own true nature. The Bodhisattva ideal recognizes that to gain enlightenment, we must develop both wisdom and compassion, both the self-regarding and the other-regarding aspects of the spiritual life. This is the basic polarity. Enlightenment within, through wisdom, manifesting without, through compassion. And this is the nature of the Bodhisattva, the one who is intent upon enlightenment for the sake of all beings.